24 hours from now, Donald Trump will take the oath of office to become the 45th president of the United States. This hour, presidential inaugurations through the lens of history. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow at this time, live inauguration coverage replaces this program. But today I'm joined by presidential historian Tim Walch and political scientist Kerry Covington. I'll ask them to put this inauguration in historical context and talk about the larger meaning of the day when one president steps down and another is sworn into office. We'll also hear excerpts from a few memorable inaugural addresses from the past. Join our conversation. First, this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow at noon, Washington time, 11 a.m. our time, Donald J. Trump will take the oath of office to become the 45th president of the United States. We can expect plenty of pomp tomorrow. Also, we hear a good deal of protest, too, as hundreds of thousands of people descend on Washington to mark the occasion. This hour, roughly 24 hours before Donald Trump is sworn in, we want to view this presidential inauguration through the lens of previous ones. To do that, I'm joined by Tim Walch. He is a presidential historian and former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in our Iowa City studio. Great to have you back in, Tim.
Good to be with you.
Kerry Covington is with us as well in our Iowa City studio, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Kerry, great to have you as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Kerry, start us off. Walk us through, in brief fashion, the events of Inauguration Day and the significance of those touchstones during the day.
Well, it's an amazing event in the sense that it signifies the peaceful transfer of power, usually from one party to another. It starts in the mornings. Some newly elected presidents will go to a church service. Franklin Roosevelt, for instance, picked the hymns at the service he went to in 1933. Then by noon, they make their way from the White House with the outgoing president to Capitol, and the streets are lined. They drive down. Jimmy Carter sort of made an exception and walked the distance. Everyone gathers at the I think it's the west side of the Capitol, looking out over the Mall. The charge to the president is made. There's usually speeches. Patriotic songs are sung. Big crowd. The president takes the oath of office, and at that moment, the old president is no longer anyone but a private citizen, and the new president has all the power.
Mm-hmm.
The old president then will normally leave. Today it'll be like, currently it's on Air Force Two, Air Force One, but it's not the presidential plane taking them wherever they're going, and the new president moves into the White House. It is amazing how much of a transition it is in the White House office itself. All the old files, all the old computer hard drives are gone, and the new president moves in, basically taking possession of official formal documents that have been handed down, but otherwise a clean slate.
Mm-hmm. A flurry of staff, computers being changed, hard drives removed. The former president tomorrow, Barack Obama, will fly away in Air Force Two. So it's a lot of planning goes into a transition like this to make it smooth, also in its technical aspects, also in its tone. But the technical aspects must be monumental, Kerry Covington.
Yeah, well, certainly it is. Just in the transfer of power, it's such a personal office, and the new president comes in with pretty much all new people, and the old president, everybody leaves. One of the big points of continuity is secretaries tend to stay, and the clerical staff is often the people who can tell you, well, here's where you find the men's room and those kinds of things.
Did I read, Kerry, that Donald Trump doesn't see his first work day as tomorrow but as Monday?
That's what he said. I wonder what he meant by that. I've heard subsequent remarks that he's going to issue some executive orders on Friday. So I don't think he's taking the time off, but I think he doesn't see himself becoming fully immersed in the presidency until Monday. Yeah.
Tim Walch, 240 years of American history leading up to this inauguration. How did we get to this point, this incredible celebration of what Kerry pointed out is something we take for granted so often, a peaceful transfer of power, which is the envy of so many peoples and so many nations around the globe.
Absolutely right, Ben. And it really starts with the inauguration, the first inauguration, which was on April 30th, 1789, when George Washington said, "I, George Washington, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States." That is all the Constitution requires the incoming president to do. George Washington added the words, "So help me God," mm-hmm. or at least that's what legend and history tell us. And there's no one here to dispute it. So all of the incoming presidents say, "So help me God." The first transition from one party to another was the first inauguration of Thomas Jefferson in 1801. And that was an important inaugural address because in many ways Jefferson set the tone for what successful future inaugural addresses are, in which he really called the people to come together, that inaugural addresses and speeches following that swearing allegiance to the Constitution are to say, we have settled our differences in this election. We want to resolve and heal our wounds, aspire to greater things, and go on. And that's what a good presidential speech aspires to do. Most presidential addresses are forgotten. It's better if they're shorter. If they're long, they can be deadly. Anyone out there remember William Henry Harrison, 8,000 words? I think it was at least an hour or two, and he had a pneumonia, lasted 30 days in office. So be careful what you have to say and make sure it doesn't come back to haunt you, so to speak. So we have proceeded from Washington in April. Every inauguration after April 30th was done as the Constitution dictated, March 4th. It was eventually changed by amendment to January 20th. Initially, it was March 4th because of travel times, just to get to the Capitol, first New York, then Philadelphia.
That was a long, lame duck period.
It was a long, lame duck period. The Congress had to assemble first. It had to tally the votes of the Electoral College and so forth. So we went from March 4th to January 20th. But moving just quickly through history, you have significant inaugurations. Thomas Jefferson, I had previously mentioned. Andrew Jackson, the people's president. He was the first controversial president, first controversial selection, passed over in a way by the House of Representatives in 1824.
Is there a way, and Carrie, get in on this too, is there a way when we say Andrew Jackson is controversial? We didn't live during that time.
No.
We have historical documents. Is there any way to measure up those controversial times, that controversial president, with our current controversy and hyper divide here, Kerry?
Well, I think the thing about Jackson was that he was not from the political class. He was not from the elite class. He's the first president from west of the Appalachians. He doesn't have any real roots in Washington. He sees Washington as a hotbed of corruption that is strangling westward expansion for the pockets of the bankers in the east. And he brings all these Westerners with him on Inauguration Day, and they basically come in and trash the White House.
It's physically trashed the White House.
There was this enormous furniture. Cheese that was given to the incoming president that they immediately consumed with their pocket knives.
Right. Well, they moved it outside to protect the White House. Yes. Yeah. Right.
Amazing.
So what was interesting was it was so controversial, you want a measure of it, that the outgoing president chose not to attend.
Right. Okay.
It was such a divisive campaign.
Something,
Jackson felt cheated the first time around.
Right. Exactly.
And so there was no sense of joining together. This was a hostile takeover.
Okay, so the boycott of Democratic lawmakers in the tens, I don't know, 40, 50, 60, however many, this is nothing new.
No, there have been periodic controversies. In fact, when U.S. Grant was sworn in as president, this is, of course, after the controversial presidency of Andrew Johnson. Johnson refused to attend and was holding a cabinet meeting while Grant was being sworn in at the Capitol. So it's not as if it's always gone smoothly, but it has been peaceful.
Right.
Let's put that in quotes.
Okay.
Right.
Well, you're both making me feel better about our partisan divide in this country, that this country has been there before and the republic has survived.
Yes.
If you just join us, we're talking about inaugurations, presidential inaugurations through the lens of history with Kerry Covington of the University of Iowa, Tim Walsh, presidential historian, formerly director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. If you'd like to join our conversation with your history-related questions about presidential scheduled inaugurations. Do join us, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. I wanted to switch gears, talk a little bit about the tone, because we'll be listening for the tone overall of the day. Of course, that presidential, that inaugural address that Donald Trump will make. We heard in the news just at the top of the hour, Vice President-elect Pence saying that the handover from the Obama administration, extremely smooth, and thanking them for this. I wanted to play a clip from 1981, January 20th, Ronald Reagan addressing in his inaugural address, President Jimmy Carter directly, and listen, then comment on the sense that you get about how important this is, one party to another, the transition of power. See how Ronald Reagan achieves this in 1981.
This is a solemn and most momentous occasion, and yet in the history of our nation, it is a commonplace occurrence. The orderly transfer of authority as called for in the Constitution routinely takes place as it has for almost two centuries, and few of us stop to think how unique we really are. In the eyes of many in the world, this every four-year ceremony we accept as normal is nothing less than a miracle. Mr. President, I want our fellow citizens to know how much you did to carry on this tradition. By your gracious cooperation in the transition process, you have shown a watching world that we are a united people, pledged to maintaining a political system which guarantees individual liberty to a greater degree than any other. And I thank you and your people for all your help in maintaining the continuity which is the bulwark of our republic.
Ronald Reagan, his inaugural address in 1981. Kerry Covington, is this a standard part of an inaugural address? Must you thank the predecessor? We talked about something who didn't even, but under normal circumstances, should you thank, as Ronald Reagan graciously did there?
Well, you think of the task before the president-elect or the new president, and that is to take on the role of being the president of all the people, the whole country. As Jefferson said, Republicans and Federalists. Barack Obama, not in his inaugural, but talked about us being Americans, not red states and blue states. That's really important because you want to build a reservoir of goodwill for your administration. And if you come in burning bridges, those bridges won't be there for you once you're in office and you need someone's help. So just as a political matter, it's essential for a president to reach out to the other side. And that's what mostly I'm watching for Donald Trump.
And especially in this case, because if there's anyone who is broken with convention,
right,
often in a brazen way, it's the president-elect.
Absolutely. In fact, just to reiterate what Kerry has said, one of his colleagues, Kathleen Hall Jamison, says there are really four benchmarks for a successful inaugural address. One is to reunite the people, and you could hear that in Reagan's words. You need review the shared values and ideas that we have as a nation. We need to set forth a vision for the future. And, of course, he needs to underscore the fact that he abides by the Constitution. You heard that in Reagan's words, and that is very definitely the blueprint for what Donald Trump has to do tomorrow.
Let's go back, reach out if you have a question, 1-866-780-9100. Tim Walsh with us, presidential historian. Kerry Covington, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa, talking about inaugural days, celebrations through the lens of history. Let's go back to another inaugural address from the past, from John Kennedy. John F. Kennedy coined perhaps one of the most famous quotations of any president in his inaugural address on January 20th, 1961. Perhaps you can guess it before even hearing this clip. It comes toward the end, but in this approximately minute-long clip, let's concentrate on the energy here and what we were talking about the focus of an administration being perhaps encapsulated in the first address given by a new president.
Only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
John Kennedy, 1961. So here we are to set the context in the middle of the Cold War. We have the nuclear threat, relatively new, bomb shelters having been built in houses all across the United States because of the nuclear threat, proxy wars in the around the world, Korea and so forth. And then we have John Kennedy doing this, Tim Walsh.
Yeah, he absolutely was trying to energize the American people. It was a passing from one generation, the World War II generation, in a way, the older generation, to a younger, newer generation, reinvigorating the American spirit. But he was very calculated. He told Ted Sorensen he wanted to keep the address short.
The speechwriter.
The speechwriter, Ted Sorensen. He wanted to look at the most successful speeches, and he looked to Lincoln. And he found that Lincoln rarely used three-syllable words. Most of the words were two syllables, so it had a certain pace to it. And you can hear in that speech, and of course the Kennedy inaugural has been one of the most successful, remains in print to this day, often as a standalone booklet, to inspire coming generations. That's a successful inaugural address.
You mentioned Lincoln. We celebrate Lincoln today. His inaugural address, though, Kerry Covington, he was not widely praised upon his election and inauguration, was he?
No, I mean, he faced a very difficult time, and his first inaugural address was quite striking and quite evocative, but it fell on deaf ears, as we know, and the southern states weren't interested. That, to me, is kind of what you have to watch in this election, is Donald Trump, no matter how eloquent his speech might be, is it going to be receptive to the people whom he's insulted or criticized during this interim period or not?
Now, Donald Trump is unique among the last seven presidents elect in reading the Washington Post, I believe, is where I'm taking this information. One, he is the only one whose popularity has dropped between Election Day and his swearing in, according to several new polls. So his popularity upon taking office, half that of President Obama's in 2009, far below even that of George W. Bush in 2001 after that contentious election, which was decided ultimately by the Supreme Court. I wonder, with his lower than average popularity appeal right now, does that add to the importance of his address? I have to think it can only add to it. There is more on his shoulders now because he doesn't, according to polls, have the majority of the people behind him.
That's right. I mean, he sets the tone. What's interesting, and to build upon what Kerry had said about will it fall on deaf ears, until really the 1920s, very few Americans heard the president read his inaugural speech. It was only the Congress initially, and then the people assembled at the Capitol who heard the speech. They read the speech in newspapers. Now Donald Trump has a multitude of communication platforms, social media and elsewhere, to communicate. So it's not only what he says, the written words that he's reading from, and of course everyone's wondering, will he use the teleprompter or will he become the Donald Trump who riffs and goes off script? And script is very much a part of what an inaugural address is. It's carefully parsed. So it's going to be a really interesting challenge.
Do presidents usually write their own inaugural addresses? We've been hearing reports that Donald Trump has, by and large, written his own here that we'll hear tomorrow. Do we know?
It's a function of time. I mean, early presidents, of course, wrote their own speeches because nobody worked for them but a handful of people. You get into the 20th century, you begin to see speechwriters appear. But presidents take ownership of these documents. They pore over them. They put a lot of red ink on them. These are definitely a distillation of who they are, probably more than any other thing they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, talked about the aspect of unifying the nation behind a new president. Is there typically an inaugural bump in popularity, Kerry?
Yeah. I looked at this because I teach classes on the presidency, and I've compared the share of the vote that the presidential candidate who won receives in the election versus their approval ratings immediately following the inauguration. And on average, there's an 11 or to 12 point bump in approval that 10 or 12% of the people who basically voted for the other guy are now saying they approve of the person they voted against. It's hard to imagine that that will happen for Donald Trump. I think part of that is on Trump, but part of that is also on the underlying polarization that's happening in the United States today. Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives have so pulled apart. There's nobody in the middle. Either you like him or you don't, and his speech isn't going to matter.
Ian is listening to our conversation before the break. Let's get in this question from Ian, formerly of Iowa. He writes, I have read recent comments that inaugural ceremonies are a holdover from Britain's monarchy and thus not befitting our increasingly egalitarian culture. Is this a fair assessment, or has the pomp and circumstance of the occasion grown in response to the growth in celebrity culture and the desire to self-identify with the president rather than viewing the office as that of a public servant? Tim, what do you have to say about
very
that?
Very eloquently said. No, but the fear that our presidents would have monarchical aspirations was a very real one, as expressed by the founders. And one of the reasons that they wanted the president to swear allegiance to the Constitution, and they also wanted him to do it in public. So at Federal Hall, on a balcony, George Washington said to the people assembled, Congress as well as to the people in the streets, you know, I pledge allegiance to the Constitution and will abide by its rules. So that it was the Constitution that drove the process of inauguration really until the 20th century, when he then began to appeal, the presidents began to appeal to the people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a friend who was in the Nixon and Ford administration. He talks to my class from time to time. Shout out to Howard. But he was actually there, and Gerald Ford wanted to do a private ceremony with no cameras, nothing present. Alexander Haig insisted, the White House chief of staff insisted that there be photographers, that this had to be seen and known because it's this transfer of power. It's such an important event. All the power of the government shifts hands from one person to another.
Okay, let's hear quickly before the break some of President Ford's. He took office without being elected by the ballot. He points it out in this clip from August of 1974. After the resignation of President Nixon, Vice President Gerald Ford taking the oath of office, sharing, here's a few of the words that he shared.
I am acutely aware that you have not elected me as your president by your ballots. So I ask you to confirm me as your president with your prayers. And I hope that such prayers will also be the first of many. If you have not chosen me by secret ballot, neither have I gained office by any secret promises. I have not campaigned either for the presidency or the vice presidency. I have not subscribed to any partisan platform. I am indebted to no man and only to one woman, my dear wife.
Gerald Ford, we're hearing from 1974.
As I begin this very difficult job.
Sorry, I stepped on the president there in our archive. We'll be back in just a minute. Kerry Covington, Tim Walsh will be with us. We're talking about the inauguration history, taking us back to previous inaugurations there after a nation being racked by the Watergate scandal. We'll talk about some other inaugural addresses. Here's some of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Also, a mistake that happened when Obama was inaugurated. Remember that? Back in just a moment with more River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. At this time tomorrow, Donald J. Trump will be the 45th president of the United States. I'm here with Tim Walsh, presidential historian and former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Kerry Covington, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa, looking at this inauguration to come tomorrow through the lens of previous ones. We'd enjoy having your questions, your comments. 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Gentlemen, let's go back as we troll through some of the archive material we have here of memorable clips from some of the most memorable inaugural addresses. Let's go back to 1933. And Tim, as a former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library, I have to go to you on this because FDR is being handed the office by the American people, and it's transferring from Herbert Hoover. I was only president in March of 1933. Let's listen, but before that, tell us a little bit about this handover.
Well, this was a very difficult transition because it's a relatively long period. We of course, elected Roosevelt in the first week of November, but then he's not inaugurated until the first week in March. The country is uncertain what direction Roosevelt will take. He was thought of as sort of a dilettante, this hale and well-met governor of New York, rich boy, often depicted by the cartoonist Ding Darling as Little Lord Fauntleroy. So people were concerned. They didn't know what was going to happen. The banks begin to crumble. There's a run on the banks in February. Hoover is unable to do anything because nobody, in effect, trusts the former president to do the right thing or to do anything that will be effective. He appeals to Roosevelt to come to Washington and help him. Roosevelt rebuffs the efforts. And so here it is, March 4th. Roosevelt kind of lurches to the podium on the arm of his son, Jimmy, to read that address, in which the people are listening, and as Kerry has reminded me, it may not be the case that at the moment he delivered these famous words, we have nothing to fear, it may not have had quite the impact until later, when of course during the first 100 days we began to take action and begin to reinvigorate the economy, really go to war with our economy. But listen to the tone and the confidence in this voice.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt delivering his first of four inaugural addresses on March 4th, 1933. Here's a snippet.
This is preeminently the time to speak the truth and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance. In every dark hour of our national life, a leadership of frankness and of vigor has met with that understanding and support of the people themselves, which is essential to victory.
Okay, Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1933 taking the White House for the first time. Kerry Covington there. Going back through this archive, we're reminded that in the 240-year history of this country, there have been many times people no longer with us, of course, thinking this is really a time of upheaval. This is a crisis. This is testing the Republic. This may bring the Republic down.
Right, right. There was a lot of sense that, in fact, Roosevelt was reported to have said, either I'm going to be one of the greatest presidents of all time or I'm going to be the last. If he didn't pull things out, we might move to some other form of more authoritarian form of government, like Mussolini, or he was very popular in places. So yeah, sometimes it's lots at stake.
Mm-hmm. And in looking back, we realize, because Roosevelt was a master of the use of the radio, the kind of social media of its era, and this is his first speech to the American people as president of the United States, and that's why it's grown in importance. I dare say there are people who weren't born in 1932 who remember hearing Roosevelt deliver that speech, so he may have come to them in a dream. But, of course, with those fireside chats that built upon what he said in that inaugural address, people began to feel comfortable with him and hear that voice, that sense of confidence. And it shows how you can combine the inaugural address with the bully pulpit of the presidency, which is the ability to communicate and using social media that makes a president powerful and important.
Yeah, Doris Kearns Goodwin gave a talk here in Iowa a year ago or so. And she made the point that successful presidents master the media as it exists, and that's probably one of Trump's big advantages. He's so far ahead of everybody else on social media, tweeting and so on. If you look at Twitter accounts before Trump, they were dead, dull. Nobody read them. He's made it a way of talking to people in an unfiltered way. And you may think that's good or bad, but he's mastered it, and that will help him once he's in office.
Some people would say that this country is in a crisis. I don't know if it is on par with the crisis that FDR faced when he came into the office, or that JFK did, or that Ronald Reagan or Gerald Ford when he took over from the resigned president Nixon. But when we look at the circumstances, Kerry, let me ask you this. When you look at the circumstances today that we find ourselves in, the condition of the economy, the world, the war on terror, let's throw that in there as one more specific there, and the character of this president, when you look at this inauguration day and Donald Trump, what we know about him so far, what questions are in your mind? What are you mulling over?
Well, part of it, I think, is we have the luxury of being protesting Donald Trump because we're not really in a crisis. If you remember, after 9/11, Democrats approved of George Bush at 90% levels. If we were really in crises, I think we would see a different kind of reaction to Trump. And so we have the luxury of expressing our protests because there's not a downside. In fact, in Democrats' minds, Trump is the crisis. We're not in crisis. He's the crisis. Mm-hmm. And so they're protesting him. So what I think is important is for him to find a way to speak to people who didn't support him in a way that they can accommodate themselves, if not support him in what he's trying to do.
That would be his number one priority in your book, is to get as many people on board to unify the nation.
Well, I'm trying to struggle for the right word, acquiesce to what he's doing.
Okay.
At least say, okay, you're the president. We'll fight you. We'll argue with you in practical terms.
And at the same time, talk about these protests, because you hear from some people say this is the most American thing. Others say this is disrespectful to the office. Which is it? Is it both?
Well, it provides a measure of discomfort for those people who do support Donald Trump, and many people would just like to see this disappear or go away. But we've had protests in the past, not only protests at the time of the inauguration, but regular protests. And as Kerry alludes to, because we have this comfort level with our freedom of speech and the willingness to gather and assemble and express what we believe, there is a genius to the process. And it's generally done peacefully. And so you have protests when Richard Nixon, particularly in 1973, is sworn in for his second term because of the Vietnam War and it not having been resolved. So you do have presidents who are controversial. But as Kerry suggests, too, if in fact he is going to be successful, he's going to have to get a majority of the American people, not just 40%, a real majority of the American people to, in effect, he said acquiesce, but sort of this notion of what the successful speech is. Come together and follow me. Will people follow him? And then the question becomes, as we're so often hearing from people who voted for Obama and then voted for Trump, can you deliver what you promised? So following me, but not off a cliff, following me to additional prosperity. And you asked about history in comparison, crises in comparison. Think about what life was like for people in 1933. I mean, a third of the nation was out of work. You had no social safety net. You had no Social Security. People were living in – they couldn't even afford a cardboard box. So we have a historical amnesia and think, oh, my life is so hard. My cable is out. That has nothing to do with the challenges faced by people in the 1930s.
Presidential historian Tim Walsh, Kerry Covington, political scientist at the University of Iowa, winding up a program where we place the inauguration to take place tomorrow to put the 45th president into office with previous inaugurations. Let's listen to a moment from 2009, Barack Obama being sworn in, had to be sworn in a second time on the second day of his presidency because of a small mistake in the recitation of the oath. Let's go back to that first attempt that didn't quite work out with Chief Justice John Roberts to listen for the oops.
I, Barack Hussein Obama,
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear
that I will execute the office of President to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute
the office of President of the United States faithfully. And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Just to be sure, we had a proper swearing in that had to be repeated, and they rehearsed it. And I bet you Donald Trump and it will be John Roberts again swearing
it
in.
Will.
Okay,
it will.
So has that changed? The Chief Justice always do the swearing in?
I believe so.
Well,
John Marshall has nine of them.
The first three, I think, were done by other judge or justices. George Washington was sworn in by a New York appellate court judge. And I think the same was true with John Adams. But starting with Thomas Jefferson.
Always a hand on the Bible? Always the Bible held by the spouse?
Doesn't have to be a Bible. Doesn't have to be a book at all.
Really?
He merely has to swear to affirm the Constitution as specified in the Constitution.
That's constitutionally speaking. As a practical matter, yes, she did.
If you swore politically, if you were sworn in without a Bible...
Not on the Manhattan telephone directory.
Right. But for instance, Lyndon Johnson, it was so chaotic.
Yes.
He swore his oath on a Catholic missal rather than a Bible because it was what was in Kennedy's drawer when they were looking for something on the airplane.
And, right. And when presidents, of course, succeed a president who dies in office, they're often sworn in by who's ever available.
Right.
Calvin Coolidge Sr., a notary public. Shout out to notary publics, swore in his son Calvin Coolidge Jr. as President of the United States by candlelight.
Tim Walsh, I know you have a list of firsts, but first of all, I want to have another snippet from the inaugural address of America's, the United States' first African-American president. He references it here in this part, to Barack Obama delivering his first inaugural address, January 20th, 2009, estimated more than 1.8 million people attending the event in Washington.
What is required of us now is a new era of responsibility, a recognition on the part of every American that we have duties to ourselves, our nation, and the world, duties that we do not grudgingly accept, but rather seize gladly, firm in the knowledge that there is nothing so satisfying to the spirit, so defining of our character, than giving our all to a difficult task. This is the price and the promise of citizenship. This is the source of our confidence, the knowledge that God calls on us to shape an uncertain destiny. This is the meaning of our liberty and our creed, why men and women and children of every race and every faith can join in celebration across this magnificent mall, and why a man whose father less than 60 years ago might not have been served at a local restaurant can now stand before you to take a most sacred oath.
Barack Obama delivering his inaugural address, January 20th, 2009. Talk about that inaugural, Tim Walsh.
1.8 million people on the mall. Even seasoned politicians who'd been to numerous inaugural addresses were overwhelmed by the number of people. I think there was a sense of affirmation and celebration that is unprecedented because, of course, a person of color was sworn in as president of the United States before the American people, before the world. So we had great hopes, great goals. And it's not that they were dashed necessarily, but it was almost an impossible mandate to fulfill.
Mm-hmm. So much during a campaign is about tearing down, about how bad the country is. If you want to be elected and you're in the opposing party, you talk about how bad a state the things are in the country. Certainly a strong point of Donald Trump in doing this, tearing down what the state of America these days. But here we hear in JFK's, in Obama's, the optimism. Did I hear an echo of JFK in Obama's speech? We are not burdened by what is to come. We are eager to tackle what is coming.
Yeah, I mean, without question.
Yeah, presidents in the campaign tear down their opponents, but they quickly develop sort of an amnesia about what they've said, and they now praise the person they've beaten or the opponent party, because the task ahead is to inspire the country to move forward, not to dwell on slights and harm and what was wrong before. I mean, Kennedy made a big deal about Eisenhower's health. He made a big deal about the missile gap, which didn't even exist. But he turned right away and was a cold warrior just like everybody else. So we're going to bear any burden for the light of freedom.
Mm-hmm. And lest we think this symbolism, this unification, attempt at unification is just a symbol, it has real translation into perhaps achievements, into the backing he might have from the Congress through the American people, Kerry?
You wish it were true. It probably doesn't really pan out that way. The honeymoon effect is more like morning fog, and it burns off under the sun of political heat.
I'll take off my rose-colored glasses now.
But it certainly is an important place to start. It's an important place to start for all the conflict that is to come.
And I would be shocked if I did not hear a paragraph from Donald Trump tomorrow praising and thanking both Bill and Hillary Clinton, as well as Barack Obama and the Obama administration, for the transition. That is absolutely required as part of this process. Now, whether or not the words will have much meaning or staying power. And it's also, I think, important to note, of course, that the other former presidents of the United States will be there. There was a time, even when Herbert Hoover was alive, that they advocated making all former presidents honorary advisors or honorary members of the U.S. Senate, because they and they alone have the experience that will help Donald Trump. Whether he chooses to accept it or value it is an open question at this point.
Tim Walz, before the hour gets away from us, I know you have an interesting list of firsts that tell us a little bit about how inaugurations have developed over history. We heard from the first black president in his inaugural address just moments ago. What else is on your first list?
People love firsts, and this is from the Library of Congress magazine. The first photograph of an individual being sworn in as president is James Buchanan, lest we forget James Buchanan and all of his fans. The first motion picture film was done by Thomas Edison of William McKinley in 1897, of McKinley being sworn in as president of the United States. First broadcast on radio, and remember we talked about the fact most people read inaugural addresses, did not hear it. First on radio was Calvin Coolidge in 1925, and I've said to folks here, I'll bet you it was on WSUI radio in 1925.
Very well, I'll bet.
First talking motion picture was Herbert Hoover in 29. First television broadcast, 1949, Harry Truman. First internet broadcast was Bill Clinton in 1997.
And this inauguration, do we know it will have some firsts? Do we know it has
live tweeting? The president of the United States would be tweeting as he's talking.
It could very very well. Your thoughts as we close this hour, fascinating hour, tying the history of inaugurals into the present day. Kerry, your thoughts to leave us with?
Well, for me, it's just the uncertainty of what lies ahead. This last 2 years have been an ongoing experience of humility, because everything we thought we knew about how elections work didn't pan out. So what we think we know about inaugurations, who knows if that's going to work. Trump comes in with unprecedentedly low approval ratings, unprecedentedly low expectations for his time in office. But he is the president. He will be the president tomorrow. And what that means and what will come from that, just have to wait and see.
Tim Walz?
One final quote from Arthur Schlesinger Jr. about inaugural addresses. The platitude quotient tends to be high, the rhetoric stately and self-serving, the ritual obsessive, and the surprises few. I think we're going to have a few surprises.
Well, that wasn't a very good promotion for our live coverage tomorrow here on Iowa Public Radio. We will have live coverage of the inauguration taking the place of this program and other programs beginning at 9 tomorrow here on Iowa Public Radio. Another first, I don't know if this is the first, Melania Trump, Donald Trump's wife, not to live in the White House, at least initially.
Yeah, that's very striking. We'll see how that plays out.
Well, of course, Martha Washington didn't live in the White House since there was no White House. Abigail did, but only under protest. What's interesting is Melania is the second foreign-born first lady after Louisa Adams, who was the wife of John Quincy Adams.
And
was
where
French.
Did she was born?
She was French, and I'm told she spoke French as a matter of course. So she did speak English, but she preferred French.
Okay. Anything else you'll be watching for during Inauguration Day tomorrow? We have a few seconds.
Just a quick shout-out for folks who want to read some more about this. Let me recommend the January 12th issue, 2009 issue from The New Yorker. The title is called The Speech. It's by Jill Lepore. It's a terrific piece. You can get it on the Internet. So it's New Yorker, Jill Lepore, L-E-P-O-R-E, The Speech.
All right. Tim Walsh with us, presidential historian, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, along with Kerry Covington, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Tim and Kerry, thanks for coming in, sharing us with us your insights about presidential inaugurations. Thank you both.
Thanks, man.
A reminder, again, our coverage tomorrow begins, preempts this program and other programs, 9 a.m. tomorrow. The whole inauguration ceremony carried live on Iowa Public Radio, courtesy of NPR. Tonight, I will be in Cedar Rapids at CSPS. We have another edition of Pints and Politics beginning at 5:30 in the evening. It's free and open to the public at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. We'll be talking about politics, of course, on the eve of the inauguration. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.